the misunderstanding or the tendency is to believe that we're out spying on people. And that is absolutely not the case. We are simply doing operator training.
Testing unmanned aircraft at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, November 26th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a tribal council argument in New Talk is holding up the process of relocating the village.
The dispute is over who are the council members who have to control the funds and the actions and the progress.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Many Alaska business owners are paying too much for energy. The Commercial Building Energy Audit Program identifies an average of 30% in energy savings. The application period runs November 1st through December 20th. To learn more, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
Unmanned aircraft systems, or UAS, will soon be flying more often over Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. Soldiers assigned to the aircraft just tested out a new runway on the base earlier this month. Officials say it will allow more training on the remotely piloted aircraft in Anchorage. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has more.
According to Chief Warrant Officer 3, Nicholas Jones, you're not likely to see an unmanned aircraft, or UA, flying around, but you might hear it.
It sounds like a very angry lawnmower.
That sound recorded from a UA flight at J-Bear earlier this month. Jones's official title is Unmanned Aircraft Systems Operations Officer with the 4th Airborne Brigade, 25th Infantry Division at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. The unmanned aircraft are like big remote control airplanes, but really, really smart, Jones says. It takes three people on the ground to operate one. The ones flying over J-Bear lately are called the Shadow. There are four of them at the base. They weigh about 375 pounds, are about 14 feet long, with a 14-foot wingspan, with straight wings. The aircraft are unarmed and used for reconnaissance missions, Jones says.
We just have a few cameras, and we're flying around for operator proficiency. In theater and combat, we do use it for full motion video. So it's kind of our one of the catchphrases is eye in the sky for the commander.
In Afghanistan, Jones says, the Shadow was used for scouting areas in front of and behind convoys. Recently, the Federal Aviation Administration approved the military's request to train on the Shadow at J-Bear, and the 27-person platoon assigned to operate the four aircraft tested them out for about 150 hours, including landing one on a new runway. The base needed FAA approval because the flight path for takeoff and landing edges out of military airspace.
The way that that runway was built means that we have to leave that restricted airspace for about 10 seconds on takeoff and landing.
Jones says the new $750,000 runway was needed because other on-base runways are difficult to land on. The new runway ensures regular training at J-Bear into the future. Jones says now that the military is scaling back overseas, more and more training is needed at home so soldiers can maintain proficiency. In Alaska, most of the UAS training used to take place at Donnelly Training Area near Fort Greeley in the town of Delta, about 2.5 hours south of Fairbanks. But Jones says that's costly, running around $30,000 several times a year. With the new runway at J-Bear, training will stay in Anchorage, and Jones says save money over the long run. Jones says there are lots of misconceptions about what the aircraft do.
Well, especially here in Alaska, and so close proximity to big population centers, I think the misunderstanding or the tendency is to believe that we're out spying on people, and that is absolutely not the case. We are simply doing operator training.
He also doesn't like them being referred to as drones. He says that's an outdated term with negative connotations that the military is trying to shake. He says drone is a word from the early days of the Air Force. They were remote control airplanes that they actually would use as targets and shoot down. And recently, Jones says, it's been used by the media and the public to refer to all remote controlled aircraft used by the military.
They do refer to them as drones, but I think drone is has a bad connotation nowadays, and everybody thinks of the attacks in Pakistan. That's not what we're doing. We don't have armament. We are there trying to find people. We've been asked in the past to do search and rescue missions. We're not flying around dropping bombs on people. So I think drone is kind of a harsh term for what we do.
There are also more than a dozen smaller handheld unmanned aircraft at the base called Raven. They're harder to see from the ground than the larger Shadow. But if you live in Eagle River, Jones says, you may catch a glimpse of the aircraft or at least hear it. But not likely until spring. The Shadow can't fly in really cold temperatures. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Alaska is also being considered as a non-military test site for drones, and legislators are drafting a policy for their use in the state. While the Legislative Task Force on Unmanned Aircraft Systems finds that the FAA's regulations on privacy and safety cover most of their concerns, the draft report they released yesterday lays out the potential for a few Alaska-specific rules. They recommend establishing a public review panel for drone use, and they want drones to be painted in high-visibility color schemes. The panel also reviewed scenarios where drone use could violate a person's privacy and concluded that most cases are covered by FAA regulations, the Alaska Constitution's privacy clause, and existing state law. Trespassing, stalking, and spying are already illegal, whether or not a person is using a drone to do it. Representative Shelley Hughes, a Palmer Republican who chairs the task force, says there's a balance between respecting people's privacy rights and allowing drones to be used in beneficial ways like search and rescue missions and wildlife research.
We don't want to single out the tool. We want to remember that if there's a problem, it would be with the operator, not the tool, and we want to be technology neutral.
The task force also finds that existing rules prohibit the arming of drones and that they require law enforcement to get warrants or approved flight plans before using them in criminal cases. A bill based on these recommendations is expected to be introduced during the upcoming legislative session. The U.S. Attorney's Office in Anchorage announced last week that four men from South Central Alaska had been charged with illegally shooting two bull moose inside Denali National Park in 2012.
The four men accused of illegal moose hunting inside Denali National Park are Charles and Derek Hart, Michael Barth, and James Riggs. Assistant U.S. Attorney Stephen Scrocky says the hunt did not take place near the boundary of the park, as has happened in some past cases of illegal moose kills. The four men had made an agreement with an innholder, someone who owns private land inside the park boundaries.
In this case, the permission from the landowner was given to hunt that specific parcel of property, and the investigation documented two bull moose that were taken outside of that property.
According to a document made public Friday afternoon, one of the two moose was shot a short distance outside the private property by Derek Hart. The second moose was killed approximately 1/2 mile into Denali National Park. Both moose were hauled back onto private property to be dressed. Stephen Scrocky says it wasn't until the hunters were on their way out of the park that they encountered rangers.
And what happened here basically was that the party was stopped on the park road because of allegations of speeding, and were interviewed as to the moose antlers that were visible on their vehicles. And that led to the Park Service to go conduct an investigation as to what they were told, where the moose were killed, and under what circumstances.
That investigation involved the National Park Service, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and the Bureau of Land Management. The illegal harvesting and transporting of the moose is a misdemeanor and could carry up to 1 year imprisonment and a $100,000 fine, according to Stephen Scrocky. One of the suspects, Michael Barth, has entered a plea agreement that, if approved, will get him off with a much lighter penalty in exchange for a guilty plea. The announcement that the four men were being charged came on the same day that Representative Don Young sharply criticized the National Park Service and Forest Service for their restriction of land use by Alaskans. One of the issues Congressman Young mentioned was the inability to legally hunt in national parks. He's proposing a plan that would allow states to take over management of national parks within their borders. One of the accused in the illegal moose killings, James Riggs, was charged for a separate offense after federal authorities used a warrant to search his home.
During the course of the search of his home, there was a silencer that was found. That's a violation of federal law, as it was an unregistered silencer, so Mr. Riggs was charged separately by indictment with that offense, and that's a felony offense.
That felony offense could carry up to a 5-year prison sentence. I'm Philip Manning.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Juno raises money for victims of Typhoon Haiyan.
I opened the envelope and I was very, very surprised with the amount. I'm not an emotional person, but at the time I'm holding back.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by the newly restored Historic Anchorage Hotel. You can find out more about this boutique hotel in the heart of downtown at historicanchoragehotel.com.
Aetna Incorporated is planning to develop natural gas wells near Glen Allen to supply local communities. The company recently licensed 44,000 acres of state land about 15 miles west of Glen Allen. Aetna Land and Resource Manager Joe Bovey says, unlike previous explorers, they aren't looking for oil to export.
It wouldn't be a real moneymaker or lucrative to any company. However, for our local demands, it would probably offset our fuel costs by at least 30 to 40%.
The data from previous exploration indicates there is enough gas to provide heat and electricity to the local area for 50 to 100 years. Bovey says the important thing about the project is it would keep people living in the Aetna region. Aetna would only earn about $100,000 to $200,000 per year, which would go toward operating costs. The current plan is to distribute gas to local residents and possibly utilities via a small pipeline. Houses and electric generators would have to be retrofitted to use gas instead of oil. Eventually, they might build a small LNG plant to get the gas to Valdez or Delta Junction. Right now, the company is working on refining seismic data gathered decades ago.
And to compare that, it's like, you know, looking at a black and white television from the 50s or 60s, reprocessing it. It will still be 2D seismic data. However, it will be more of a flat screen HD colored type, so we can reevaluate that.
Then the company will know where to build a production pad and start drilling. They hope to be done with exploration before the Middle Earth Frontier tax credits expire in mid-2016. State lawmakers passed the credits in 2012 to encourage oil and gas exploration in areas outside of the North Slope and Cook Inlet. He says the credit makes exploration worthwhile and ultimately will be a good deal for the state.
The cost savings at the school district, i.e. the state of Alaska, would have to be paying to operate the Glen Allen school over 10, 20 years would save whatever you would end up paying in tax credits to a company to explore for natural gas or oil in a Middle Earth Frontier tax credit area.
Bovey says the company hopes to be sending gas into homes by early 2017. The latest round of Bering Sea storms beat up the southwest Alaska coastline, including Nutok. The community's move to the Mekdagavik site on Nelson Island may be more pressing than ever, but their long relocation process is in a holding pattern due to a tribal council dispute. KYUK's Ben Matheson reports.
Residents in Nutok have known for years that their community faces serious risks with rapidly advancing erosion. The recent November storms pushed up water to the community's essential infrastructure.
It's really bad. I mean, the erosion is really near. The fuel header is being impacted right now. It's just around the erosion, and the water source is getting there. Our last water source will be impacted next summer.
Stanley Tom describes himself as the tribal administrator for the tribal council, that is, the old council, which does not have the support of the BIA or the state. The struggle between the old and new councils led to a wasted 2013 construction season at the emergency shelter at the new site. The dispute is built around the idea that the old council did not hold elections for 7 years. In October of last year, elections were held and the old council was voted out. George Carl is vice president of the new council. He points to the community being upset with perceived competency issues at the old council.
Well, I'd call it a playhouse. After the expiration of their terms, you know. Well, that if you understand what's going on, you know, according to my understanding, these guys were illegal operating all these years without any elections or that kind of stuff.
The old council points to different elections from November in which those members retain their seats. In any case, the agencies that fund projects like the relocation can't have dueling councils.
there's not two councils out there. There's only one council. The dispute is over who are the council members who have to control the funds and the actions and the progress.
Scott Ruby is the director for the State Division of Community and Regional Affairs. The agency started working with the new council after BIA issued its decision in July to work with the new council. It hasn't been a smooth transition. The old council has not given the new council access to the offices or important financial records. They've had to set up new bank accounts. Stanley Tom accuses the new council of stealing letterhead and documents. In the meantime, the community's trying to move. They have about $10 million in grants through the state with $4 million spent, but perhaps not all properly. An audit by the state found some troubling accounting, and the state wants $302,000 back, according to Ruby.
Preliminary findings are what there were some double billings of some of the expenses that were filed for materials and purchases, and that there was some inconsistencies in the payroll. And so the audit as it is now says that we will consider some of these expenditures not to be valid, and they need to be repaid.
Stanley Tom says that goes back to accounting mistakes from when the DOT was managing the project before local leadership took over. The audit highlights some of the wages that Tom received, along with project consultant George Olatuck.
We did get paid way less than the state agencies were getting paid. You know, they were getting $168 an hour, and we were way below. Like, we billed our, like, $80 an hour, and they were still complaining.
With or without their longtime leader, the project is inching back to life, and the 2014 construction season is not that far off. The evacuation shelter is now just an empty concrete foundation and will require new drawings to be able to use materials that sit on the site. Ruby says the tribal council is not yet spending funds, but it's able to do the background work.
Coming up next summer, these are the things that need to get done. Let's work on getting this stuff ready so we can order whatever materials need to be ordered for the barges so they can be put on the barges. Let's, you know, do whatever permits need to get done.
In the meantime, the old council is appealing the BIA's decision. They say they have proof of elections. The case is going to a national board, which could wait a year before it takes up the appeal. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
The state has ordered a Seattle-based medevac insurance program to end coverage in Alaska. Airlift Northwest's air care program fills the gap between air ambulance charges and what health insurance pays. Marty Hester of the Alaska Division of Insurance says it's changed the way it does business. That means it has to follow a different set of rules.
The exemption that they were operating under was as a nonprofit, and with their corporate restructure, they were no longer deemed a nonprofit. Therefore, the exemption no longer applied to them.
The decision will not affect Airlift Northwest's ability to provide medical evacuation flights in the state. Airlift Northwest began more than 30 years ago as part of the University of Washington's medical system, which also includes hospitals and clinics. It operated for a while as a separate nonprofit group, but it moved back to the university a few years ago. Executive Director Chris Martin says Airlift Northwest remains a nonprofit agency under Washington state rules, so she's disappointed Alaska officials decided it isn't.
We have a business license with the state of Alaska. We have, you know, our Juneau base in the state of Alaska. Nothing has changed. And this letter to us came out of the blue.
Martin says the AirCare program has more than 1,600 Alaska members. They've all been sent a letter saying coverage will end when their year-long membership runs out. The program also will not enroll any new Alaska members. The State Insurance Division's Hester says the issue is not at all related to the Affordable Care Act. He says Airlift Northwest voluntarily complied with the order, and he says it could change its Alaska program and resume business.
If they decide to become compliant with Alaska insurance statutes and offer an insurance product, an approved insurance product, then they'd be able to offer the membership program.
Airlift Northwest's Martin says it started the AirCare program to fill a need, not to make money. So she says that's not going to happen.
You know, we are part of the University of Washington, and our mission is air medical transport, not insurance, and nor is the university's.
Most of its Alaska business is in Southeast, but it also serves Anchorage and other parts of the state. Its main competitor, Utah-based Guardian Flight, does not have a similar membership program. Fairbanks-based Apollo Meditrans offers medevac insurance in Alaska. The state shut it down for part of this year after it failed to renew its license. State officials say it's not affected by this decision.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by ERA. For more than 40 years, ERA Alaska's planes have carried the stories of Alaska. ERA Alaska, bringing Alaskans together. More at flyera.com.
Rain in interior Alaska is rare, or so it might seem, but the region has seen rain fall in November in 7 of the last 12 winters. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, an explanation remains elusive.
Rick Toman is the Climate Science and Services Manager for the National Weather Service in Alaska. After a fierce winter storm brought freezing rain to the Fairbanks area this month, he decided to do some detective work.
This is part of forensic climatology.
While forensic climatology isn't actually a science, Toman has spent the last few weeks combing through more than a century's worth of climate data for the region. He says wintertime rain has pelted the interior before.
We can see that both in the 1960s and in the 1920s and 30s, there was even more winter rains than we've had lately.
Those periods were separated by decades with few, if any, rain events. Toman says there isn't a distinct pattern to rain-laden storms in the winter, so he doesn't really have an explanation.
Well, we actually have not been able to find the smoking gun in this case. Does not appear to be well correlated with any of the usual things that we look at for driving winter climate in interior Alaska.
Those are things like sea surface temperatures in the North Pacific Ocean.
And that perhaps is less surprising than we might think, because these are very specific weather events. And those kind of climate drivers like sea surface temperature anomalies tend to operate over longer timescales, where these is just one or two or three day type events.
So even if his investigation is inconclusive, Toman says it might be a good idea to keep an umbrella nearby.
The periods in the 1920s and 30s and in the 1960s lasted longer than what we've had so far. So just based on that past record, we might expect more of these in the relatively near future. But we have to remember that these don't all have the same mechanisms behind this. And it's certainly a good example of how the past may not be a guide to the future.
The forecast for this, the last week of November, calls for clouds over the interior and maybe a few snowflakes, but no mention of rain. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
Juneau's Filipino community will contribute more than $21,000 to the relief effort for victims of Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines. That's the amount raised during Saturday's fundraising dinner. KTOO's Lisa Fu was there and has this story.
The dinner was scheduled to start at 5 p.m., but by 4:45, there was already a line of people waiting outside the Filipino Community Hall in downtown Juneau. By 5:15, the building was packed. Made in Cristobal was selling tickets.
It's pretty busy. We are swamped. There's a lot of people, and we have a lot of donations.
Tickets sold for $15 per plate.
Some were paying $50, and some were giving out a $100 bill for a $15 plate dinner.
Dante Reyes is president of Filipino Community Incorporated. Shortly after Typhoon Haiyan struck the Philippines November 8th, the nonprofit decided to cancel its annual free Thanksgiving Day meal and instead hold a fundraising dinner and auction.
So let's hear another bid. We have $150, and it goes to such a great cause. $175, $200, $225.
Juneau Representative Kathy Munoz was one of the auctioneers. State legislators and past and present assembly members stood with members of Filipino Community Inc. to help serve food to about 515 people. The evening brought in more than $21,000. Reyes says some of the gifts were very personal, like Gabriel Kelly's donation. Reyes says Kelly was raising money for his own trip to France and decided to give half of it to the fundraiser.
I opened the envelope and I was very, very surprised with the amount. It was $1,000 check. I'm not an emotional person, but at the time I'm holding back something. Somebody not a Filipino, not related to Filipino. Instead of having that for himself, he shared it to those who need that big amount of money in the Philippines.
A portion of the total money raised will go to Juno's sister city in the Philippines, Calibo, which is in Aklan province.
Aklan, too, was damaged by Typhoon Haiyan. It is also on the path of the Typhoon Haiyan going out of the Philippines. And it also has devastated not only homes and properties, but also some human lives.
Joselyn Ferrer is on the Filipino Community Inc. Board of Directors. Ferrer is from the Visayas region, one of the areas hardest hit by Haiyan. Almost every Filipino at the fundraiser was affected in some way by the typhoon.
We're hanging in there. I mean, we're all strong, keeping everybody strong for each other. But with the help of the community, the whole Juno community, this is definitely giving us more of a boost.
Ferrer says she was overwhelmed by how many people were at the dinner, especially since it was such a last-minute event.
It looked like, just like the Filipino community, Filipinos managed to put it all together and hang in there. And like they say, rise up, Philippines, and we will do that.
Reyes says funds will go to a few different organizations, including an international foundation based in the U.S. and Philippines, Catholic Relief Services, and Red Cross. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, Philip Manning in Talkeetna, Ben Matheson in Bethel, Ed Schoenfeld and Lisa Fu in Juneau, and Emily Schwing in Fairbanks. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Ann Hillman from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Crowley, celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority is developing the Kinnick Arm Crossing to further develop the transportation system between Anchorage and the Matsu Borough. The bridge could create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and shorten the route to Alaska's interior and North Slope. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. Many Alaska business owners are paying too much for energy. The Commercial Building Energy Audit Program identifies an average of 30% in energy savings. The application period runs November 1st through December 20th. To learn more, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.